Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 294. What if you could build charts in Python by describing what your data means instead of scripting every visual detail? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We cover a recent Real Python article about the data visualization library Altair. Most tools require you to write detailed boilerplate code to set up the axis and figure. Altair follows a declarative approach where you specify which columns go to which axis, the type of chart or plot, and what should be interactive. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including recent releases, clarifying the differences between iterators and iterables, decoupling your business logic from the Django ORM, comparing an LLM-based tool for web scraping against Playwright, a neural network emulator for guitar amplifiers, and a CLI tool to generate ASCII art of the current moon phase. This episode is sponsored by Build Your Own Coding Agent, a hands-on guide to writing your own cursor or Claude code clone in pure Python. No lang chain, no vector databases, no frameworks. Just requests, a tool loop, and code you can debug with print. Listeners get 10% off with code REALPYTHON at buildyourowncodingagent.com. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back to the show.
Hi there.
So we are digging into our usual lineup. We got a couple news items, topics, a discussion, a very personal discussion in this case for me, and then a couple projects. One I'm actually very excited to talk about. So you ready to dig in?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
So starting off with a small break from the usual release news, got a couple items here. First is the folks from Read the Docs. If you're not familiar, they're an open source project that hosts documentation and a lot of Python projects use it. They've announced that they have integrated UV into their systems, which makes it easier to use the same tools you're building locally with for your documentation at RTD. We've linked to an article that shows you how to modify your .readthedocs YAML file to get this going, so that's exciting. And the second bit of news is about an upcoming change to Python 3.14 and 3.15. It's not even out yet and they're revisiting it.
Yeah.
So you might recall that some changes were made in Python 3.14 to how the garbage collector worked. It was a new incremental garbage collector, which was meant to be more efficient. There have been multiple reports from use in production that there are possibly some memory issues, not collecting when it should be collecting, that kind of stuff. So as such, they're going to roll this change back. This will take effect in the next release. 3.14.5 was planned for June, but if they get the code version in earlier than that, they may release earlier to get the fix out as quickly as possible. Likewise, the next 3.15 was supposed to be a beta, and they want to try and keep that into the beta if the reversion happens in time. If you're interested in how this affects code in the real world, we're also going to link to an article by a friend of the show, Adam Johnson, who ran into this issue while doing a Django migration with one of his clients. He wrote his experiences up on his blog, so you can kind of see, you know, what this actually looks like in practice and why they want to do something about it.
Yeah. I think it's going to creep up on anybody who's doing a really large project like he was doing there.
Yeah, and it kind of shows you just how hard it is to, like, you make an improvement and, oh, hey, that's 10 or 15% better for 80% of the cases, and maybe that's a good thing. But if it's, and I'm not saying it is, but if it were 50% worse for the remaining 10%, yeah, you might not want to do it, right? And this is always the trade-offs that we have to deal with.
Yeah. All right, well, right into topics then. I like to cover visualization libraries, and I discussed kind of a roundup of them recently. And in that review, I talked about a library called Altair that I hadn't explored yet, and I've been thinking about looking into it. And timing's perfect this week. RealPython has a tutorial by Valerio Maggio, and it's titled Altair Declarative Charts with Python. And so the title reinforces something else that we kind of been discussing lately, the idea of imperative versus declarative in the world of programming and the world of like libraries and how they kind of work. If you're not familiar, you can think of it as imperative programming specifies exactly how to perform tasks step by step, while declarative focuses on what the desired outcome should be, allowing the system to determine how to achieve it. And many of the libraries that I've covered before, or actually even done courses on, such as Bokeh or Matplotlib, fall much more into the imperative mode, where you're instructively saying this element here, and you can kind of build it exactly how you want. Well, Altair is much more in the declarative style. In the second paragraph of the piece, he does a good job summing everything up. Instead of scripting every visual detail, you describe what your data means. This includes specifying which column goes on which axis, what should be colored, and what should be interactive, and then Altair generates the visualization. Another unique feature of Altair is that it generates web native charts as HTML and JavaScript, which is great for a lot of cases, especially if you're working in notebooks or as standalone HTML files that you can share and embed in web pages. There are some other circumstances where that might be a little awkward, so keep that in mind. The tutorial takes you through not only getting started with installation, but building your first chart, which takes very little code. The code example has you import Altair and pandas, make a quick data frame. In this case, it's like days of the week and steps walked. And so setting up a chart takes one line of code plus defining the X and Y axes. So he has weekly steps equal alt dot and then chart. What is it covering? And then you have your data as a parameter there. And then mark, in this case, underscore bar, which means that it's going to be a bar chart, and then dot and code. And that's where you then specify the parameters you want for the axes, X equals day and Y equals steps. And then you call that chart that you've created, the weekly steps, to have it show up. The example you're doing inside of a Jupyter notebook. So when you call that variable, it would show below in the cell. So you need three things to get a chart or plot defined: data, usually a data frame, the type of mark, this is the visual shape that you want, mark underscore, and then whatever the type is going to be. So mark underscore bars draws a bar chart. Other options might be mark underscore point. That might be for like a scatter plot or something like that. Mark underscore line or mark underscore arc, which is kind of like, could be maybe used for like pie like charts. That's a bit of a limitation in the library. And then encode, and this is where the mapping, you choose your columns of what are going to be the visual properties you want. So inside there, you would have encode and then day being the x-axis or y for steps. The tutorial continues with exploring multiple dimensions with encoding channels. And to take advantage of this, you use a feature that many of these recent visualization libraries have been showing, which is built-in data sets, which is nice. I like that. That's something, again, I remember in the R world being a little more common. This one's got a nice one, movies data set, which is an internet movie database built in for you to play around with and query. As you define channels in Altair, there's a sort of a shorthand for types. The types that you would use for interpreting whatever the column values are can be colon Q, which is for quantitative stuff. So basically any type of number. Colon N, nominal. Those are unordered categories. Colon O for ordinal or ordered categories. And then colon T for temporal. So this is kind of how it can do a little bit of the stuff behind the scenes of like, again, I'm just declaring the things that I want and it's going to work out the specifics behind the scenes. You build a scatter plot looking at worldwide gross versus production budget on some movies, but he adds a few extra dimensions, what genre these things group into, major genre, and then the IMDb rating. So he has primarily the scatter plot and it's showing the gross versus production budget. When you hover over a point, it has a bit of interactivity built in ready to go just with those two things where it'll show then the film's title and then it automatically grabs that IMDb rating. It also then created legends on the side for the genre and the IMDb rating. Altair sort of inferred what to do with that. The tutorial continues showing you how to add interactivity with like selections. He sets up an interaction between two visualizations, one being that scatter plot that we were talking about before, and then a bar chart that's below it. And then this kind of in-between tool called a brush, that's what he names it, which is the selection. And then as he adds that other bar chart, he adds, again, that is the one that's sort of interacted based upon what you've selected in the scatter plot, what points you've selected, the brushing over them, like I guess like a paintbrush. So based on that selection, he has it doing the genre versus the mean IMDb rating appearing in the bar chart. The additional code to set this up for the chart is when he's building that to add something called transform underscore filter, and then that brush sort of selection. It's a nice example to show you fundamentally how you could think of interactivity inside the library. And he wraps up the tutorial with a section about Altair's limitations and its gotchas. It has a real limit as far as data sets, which I don't normally hear about, but that was something mentioned when I talked about it a couple weeks ago. Over 5,000 rows triggers a max rows error by default. So there are some workarounds. He mentions a link to them. You could aggregate your data or use some other solutions that he mentions in the link to the documentation. I'll note again, it renders it to HTML, so you have to keep that in mind. There are ways to convert. It's somewhat limited in its customization. If you require matplotlib detailed stuff where you're like, okay, I'm going to have my own, we talked about the sort of style libraries you can have for it. That's not something that's here. If you want custom layouts or precise typography, or you want to have other kinds of details, you might maybe lean towards something more like matplotlib. It does not do 3D plots, and it doesn't have native pie charts. It really expects your data to be tidy, meaning cleaned and ready to go. Some of Altair's APIs change, and that might happen between major releases. This was true where it added the data sets, which actually I think is a positive thing. But yeah, it's a library that's already at version 6, so they aren't afraid to break things. So just be aware of that. The tutorial has a nice one of our new RealPython FAQ sections at the bottom of it, along with a quiz to test your newfound knowledge. So thanks, Valerio. I'm looking forward to what you write next. This episode is brought to you by Build Your Own Coding Agent. If you've ever used Cursor or Claude Code and wondered what's actually happening under the hood, this book gives you the answer by having you build one yourself. 12 chapters, around 750 lines of Python, PyTest tests throughout. You'll wire up the tool protocol, build a memory file, add a plan, then act mode, and even hook in local OLAMA models. No frameworks, no LangChain, no vector databases. Just raw HTTP and subprocess. RealPython listeners get 10% off with code RealPython at buildyourowncodingagent.com. Chris, what do you got first here?
My first article this week is by Carlton Gibson, a key contributor to the Django framework. The article is titled Decoupling Your Business Logic from the Django ORM. And although it is about Django projects, the reasoning really is wider than that. For anyone listening who isn't a database person, ORM stands for Object Relational Mapping, and it's a technique that maps your database content into an object-oriented model. So if I have a person class with a first and last name, the ORM maps that to the person table in the database, providing first and last name columns for the storage. By complete coincidence, I was flipping through Blue Sky this morning, came across a clip of us talking about ORMs, and I used that exact same example. So there's a fine line between consistency and old man repeating himself. But anyways, if you're designing an application that uses an ORM, the question arises of where to put your business logic. If you have a page or a screen in your app that is responsible for doing something with the person, how much of the code for that something should go on the model object itself, or should some of it go on a layer responsible for the page or screen? In Django, the code that produces the web pages are called views. So it's really a fundamental design question. Should business logic go in the view or on the model object instead? The topic comes up in the Django world a fair amount, and the usual rule of thumb advice is that you put your business logic in the view. Code on the object is only meant to be about controlling the object. For large projects, though, this might not be the right answer. And Carlton's article is about how to evolve your code over time as the project changes and grows. The reasoning behind keeping things in the view is this is where the page is getting invoked, which is tied to what the user is trying to accomplish. If I have an action like submit taxes, April was recent, although that may interact with the person object, the submission itself really is the business logic. So it makes sense to keep that with the page handling the view for that activity. When your application grows, what might start to happen is more and more common code is needed across the views. This typically means moving that into a function or a library or a service layer of some sort. In Django, at least, one of the natural places to put that service layer is in an object manager, which goes on the model. So we're back to putting code on the person. So we've got this trade-off thing happening. The general philosophy behind an ORM object in Django is that it's supposed to represent a single row in a table in the database. Although it might be convenient to keep some common code there, too much extra stuff tends to make the line between storage and business logic blurry. One place this creakiness tends to show up is when you're trying to be more efficient by querying less things from the database. The example Carlton uses in the article is a bookmark class with attributes for a URL, title, some notes, and a Boolean to say whether or not it's a favorite, and of course a foreign key to the user that owns the bookmark. So for a small site, you likely would just query the object and be done with it. But that notes field might be quite large, as it's a freeform text where users can type whatever they were thinking. If you're displaying a list of bookmarks, you probably don't need that notes field. There are ways of doing this kind of query in Django without getting everything back, but it requires a little extra code. And of course, then comes the question, where do you put that? If you put that logic in the view, it can't be reused. But if you put it in the bookmark model object, it can start to get unwieldy because you've got this very specific thing which is supposed to be on a general storage object. This gets even messier if you need information about the associated user. User objects tend to have a lot of fields on them, and you likely don't need them all, probably just the username and ID. If you don't do this query correctly, it can mean many extra hits to the database, and there's performance costs with that. At scale, one of the patterns that Carlton has had success with is to have a separate object. For our example, that would be a plain Python object with only the attributes you're interested in querying. There are then ways of mapping between the bookmark data object and the bookmark model object. Of course, to make your life easier, there is a library for that, Django Mantle, which Carlton is involved in. Mantle has its own query mechanism, which you pass your ORM data and data class to, and then it does all the hard parts, giving you the optimized query, returning only those things that you need. For those who've done the, you know, API interface type stuff, this feels to me kind of like the ORM equivalent of GraphQL versus REST, giving you flexibility of querying exactly what you want and the efficiency of not getting back anything more than that. The bigger question of where to keep your logic and how to change it over time is an interesting one. So even if you're not a Django person, this article is worth the read to better understand the trade-offs and what you might do differently on your own projects.
Yeah, I worked in... when I was in Hawaii at a couple different banks, and one of the vendors we ended up meeting with and setting up was with IBM for Cognos. I don't know if you're familiar with that system.
Yep.
I was really intrigued by this idea of like pre-calculating a bunch of aggregations and things that would then be queryable or usable. It was like, you know, modifying database elements in advance, which it feels a little bit like that.
Yeah, there's some interesting things here. And one of the things I really kind of like about the article is often when you see these kinds of opinion pieces on the internet, it's, you should do it this way.
Yeah.
Carlton's like, yeah, no, you know, you're probably going to start this way and then you're going to change it a little bit. And then, you know, and that's a great answer, right? So
Even
in thinking about those things, one of the things he talks about is how to model it so that if you're going to shift that over time, that making that shift is easy, right? So you want enough encapsulation of your code that if you decide you want to move the code, you can move it more or less piecemeal rather than having to find, you know, all the little strands of spaghetti to weave them together. My analogy's falling apart into a spaghetti blanket.
Exactly.
That's what you do with spaghetti. Sure.
Mm.
Spaghetti blanket.
All right. Nice and warm. All right. Yeah, I think this might actually come up again, being that I'm going to talk a little bit about projects today. My next one is from Quintron at CodeCut, and we've featured a handful of stuff that she's covered recently. This article is titled Browser Use, that's tied together with a dash, it's a particular library, versus Playwright. Which should you pick for web scraping? The premise is, can you get an LLM to work through web scraping better than a tool like Playwright? And it's interesting to me because I always think of Beautiful Soup in there, but Playwright's become kind of a little more standard in some circumstances because it can do a few more sort of browser sort of actions. And I think in today's age with the way things are rendered, maybe something like Playwright is becoming more popular for it. So this is like another step removed. Traditional browser automation requires you to write CSS selectors for like the elements that you want to extract from the page. And it ties it really strongly to the HTML structure. Scraping has always been sort of susceptible to this problem, which is people change their web page. And as it gets updated, all your custom built scrapers break. So the article's digging into the idea like, well, what if you could just describe it in plain English, kind of going back to that idea of a bit of a declarative type of thing. Browser Use is a Python library that gives you an LLM working in a browser. Under the hood, it uses Playwright to drive the browser, but the LLM reads each page and decides what to click, type, and extract. You write the task in plain English, and the agent figures out the rest. So that's a quote from the article there. Quint takes you through installing Browser Use, configuring it to work with an LLM. She chooses OpenAI's GPT-4o, and then she talks a little bit about something that a handful of people always seem to forget, which is like not saving your credentials in your project. So how to use a .env file for storing your API key. And then the next part of the piece is taking you through sort of, if you will, step-by-step of like, how do I set this up? The concept is find the top AI-related stories on the front page of Hacker News, and then identify the common themes between them. And as you work through the code and start to run it, the log that's output is actually really descriptive. And that's one nice thing about maybe embedding LLMs in some ways. Very often, it will tell you what it's done and how it sort of processed going through it. The tool actually finds a couple flaws as it's working. The tool uses a couple workers. One does the initial scraping and categorizing. And then once that worker declares success, a second LM steps in as a judge to say, well, I'll be the judge of how successful that was. And in this case, most of the output was solid. There were structured fields that were accurate. There were the titles, the points, the comments, the URLs, and so forth. It kept all that information. There were the themes that it found, and they did relate to the original stories. Its summaries read like a take, not a list, which is kind of nice in some ways. So it did kind of give a nice little short summary. It did grab a couple stories that weren't AI, unfortunately. And so the judge had to point that out, which was good that it found that. So the piece shows doing some of the additional wrangling with that output and how to set it up. And then it covers kind of a unique wrinkle to this approach, which is, well, how much did that cost? So she shows some quick code that could pull out usage statistics from this history.usage object that gets created there. And in that particular query, the total of tokens was 42,000. Total cost, I would say, as the time of that writing, was 12 cents. How many steps were taken? 3 steps, and the duration was 53 seconds. So 12 cents per run may not be too much of use, but it depends on your use case and how many times you're going to run the thing. She shows another quick example, scraping pricing from Newegg about laptops. This one was a little less successful. It had some issues not following the constraints that she had set in there. She had said, hey, it needs to be at least 32 gigs of RAM, and it just kept providing 16 gig models. There might be another reason for that, but anyway, right now it's a little hard to find a good computer with lots of RAM in it. The piece wraps up with a bunch of trade-offs. Browser Use is powerful, but it has its own problems, like the speed. It's going to be much slower than Playwright typically for a similar task. Maybe it'll take a minute compared to 5 seconds. There's a cost to it. Yes, 12 cents may be cheap, but that cost could grow quickly, especially if you try to turn it into a product. And then you're never always sure of like, well, how well is that thing running and so forth. A bit of non-determinism results varied between runs. The agent may take different actions and the judge might reach different conclusions. And then it may not work on all types of pages. It really depends on the type of site, which is true of all of these things. There's a final comparison chart. When might you want to choose Playwright? When you need identical results every run, when the speed matters, high volume or frequent runs, and you need it to match very specific exact constraints. When would something like browser use work better? The task requires the judgment or classification rather than just pattern matching. The task requires synthesis across multiple items, and then the page, if it changes or you think it might change often, it might help and you don't have to maintain very specific selectors. You want scraping, classification, and reasoning, all of that maybe in one whole prompt. So interesting new tool. LLMs might be a useful thing to add to your web scraping. So thanks, Quinn.
I don't know if it's a myth or not, but I remember years and years ago hearing that drug lords were money laundering through RAM because the cost of them, like, it's kind of like diamonds. It doesn't, the amount of money involved in a small thing. And so it's easy ship them around. And
right.
So, yeah,
could be
another side effect of the onslaught of AI is money laundering for drug lords. So there you go. Yeah, something else we can blame Sam out with.
That was the several friends in my feed have said, oh, I've gone into my attic and pulled all the RAM out of my old computers. Like, I don't know if it's going to work like that, brother, but
But when you start seeing it in pawn shops, that's when you'll know.
Yeah, exactly. On the same note, if you would like to learn more about the concept of web scraping, never done it, and if you're interested, we have a really great course that's based on that library I mentioned before, Beautiful Soup. And so if you'd like to learn a little more of the ins and outs and how to pull information off the web. So what do you got next here?
My next article is by Ned Batchelder, and it's titled 2048, Iterators and Iterables. Ned was building a little text-based version of the 2048 game. If you're not familiar, it's a sliding tile puzzle where you mash together tiles with the same numbers, resulting in a new tile with their sum. If you do it well, you end up with one single remaining tile and the number 2048 inside of it, hence the name. The game board has a 4x4 grid on it, and so a tile can be able to slide left, right, up, or down, depending on its position. To deal with this, Ned's code sometimes had to loop from 0 up to 3, and other times from 3 down to 0, just to iterate over the rows and columns in the tile slides. His first attempt used Python's built-in range function, setting a negative step when necessary to go backwards. This resulted in a lot of if-then-else blocks and a couple ugly range calls, so he decided to do something clever, or at least something he thought was clever. He used a single call to range and then used the built-in reversed function to switch its direction when necessary. This didn't work, and the reason it didn't work is the premise behind the article. The problem's a little subtle. Range returns an iterable, something that can be iterated over. When you use range within a for loop, the for loop takes the iterable and creates an iterator, the thing used to do the actual iterating. As an aside, that's what the built-in iter function does in Python. It takes an iterable and returns something that can be iterated over. This resulting thing is called an iterator. The difference here is one of state. Range returns an object that encapsulates the start, end, and step size of a range. It doesn't actually have the sequence inside of it. This is why when you evaluate a range in the REPL, you need to pass it to a list to see the result. An iterator, on the other hand, contains the current state of the iteration. If I'm generating a sequence from 1 to 10, this is the thing that knows I've already asked for two things, and when I'm going to ask for the next thing, I want 3. So iterables are stateless when it comes to the iteration, while iterators are the stateful things which actually enable the iteration. All right, back to the cleverness that wasn't so clever. Although range returns an iterable, reversed returns an iterator, a stateful thing. Once you've gone through the iteration, an iterator is empty. You can't reuse them because they've already been exhausted. In Ned's code, he had a nested loop, the outer loop for the rows and the inner loop for the columns. The rows part worked fine, but when it came to do the columns the second time, the second loop of the outer loop, the iterator returned from reversed would be empty and you'd get nothing back.
You've exhausted it.
Yes. Yeah. So you've got this clean looking code and you test it and it's like, why isn't it doing anything?
Yeah.
So the solution isn't terribly difficult. In fact, it's the same trick I mentioned earlier of viewing a range object in the REPL. If you pass the result of reversed to a list, well, lists are iterables. So you can use them and then get a new iterator each time you need to go through the loop. And in fact, that's called a list iterator. So that solves the problem. Interestingly, there's an alternate way of achieving the same result, and that's to slice the range instead of using reversed. So the slice is that thing inside of the square brackets that gets that part of an iterable. So for example, square brackets 2:4 gives you the third and fourth item in a container. A lesser used feature of the slice is you can also specify the step size, similar to the step size argument to range. So if you slice :-1, you get back a reverse of the collection. If you do this with a range object, what you get back is a new range object, which of course is iterable. So instead of using reversed and a list, if Ned had used the -1 reversing slice, he wouldn't have had the problem. If you're new to iterators and how they work, the distinction between an iterable and an iterator can be a little confusing. Ned's article has some nice code examples to show you the difference. Or if you'd like to dive deeper, we've got an article at RealPython that shows you all the ins and outs of all these pieces.
And Mr. Trudeau has made a video course of that too, if you're interested.
Yes, of course. If you don't want to read, you can listen to me natter on. Yeah, you've always got a choice.
This week, I want to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It's titled, Use Codex CLI to Enhance Your Python Projects. Codex CLI is an AI-powered coding assistant that runs inside your terminal. It understands your project structure, reads your files, and proposes multi-file changes using natural language instructions. And the video course is based on a RealPython tutorial by Rodrigo Girao Serrao. And it's presented by Rodrigo himself. Instead of learning how to copy code from a browser or relying on an IDE plugin, you'll use Codex CLI to implement a real feature in a multi-file Python project directly from your terminal. And through the course, you'll install and configure Codex CLI, use it to implement features in the ContactBook app, and refine the features through iterative prompting. And after watching the video course, you'll be able to use Codex CLI to add features to your Python projects directly from your terminal. Like most of the video courses on RealPython, the course is broken into easily consumable sections and has code samples for the techniques shown. All our lessons include transcripts, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes. Or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. All right, well, that takes us into our discussion this week. For this one, it's kind of a personal one. I've been getting back into consulting. I have a particular client who I've worked with before, and they are interested in me taking some tools that I've built for them to use out in the field and turn those applications, modernize them, and maybe even add some additional features on top of them. And so what I wanted to do is just sort of, I've actually been having conversations with Chris a little bit off the mics to think through my theories and so forth. But we thought it might be useful to loop the audience in here and talk about, well, what goes into taking a modern project on. There's some really unique things here about this particular project. It's for a small company. I have access to the individuals who are going to use the tool. It's a very small team developing the software, me. So there's no project manager slash coders or other people involved. It's just me building these things. And it's also, I put some constraints in when I created the original projects and tools that they use, and they love them. And they tell me every time I talk to them how much they love them. So, which is great, but I want to not provide them with something inferior then. So first off, I thought about like, well, we could talk about how I'm approaching the project. You know, what are the options for the equipment what they will be, what the client's needs are, and then determining what the output needs to be. I've never written any of this sort of process out as far as like the steps that I take. It's all been very, very intuitive for me. I knew that I wanted to meet with the person who was going to do the stuff in the field. And then I had them provide me with what they were doing it with. So I'll mention one particular tool that they use, which was for doing water sampling. They were looking at groundwater. This is for an environmental science company. And so they had to test the water and take enough samples when the machine that's pulling this water out of the ground to test it was clear enough. They were using, at the time, pen and paper on clipboards. And you can imagine that's maybe a pretty dirty environment. And I always thought to myself, what a mess of like, you know, taking these pieces of paper. As I noticed them, a lot of the fields were not filled in. They only seemed to fill in parts of different areas, like felt they could like maybe skip through things. And I thought, well, that's probably bad for data entry, that they should have all the values in there and it should be required for them to move forward. But I could see how that's kind of a pain. So maybe we should use something that's portable, like an iPad. And I had an idea of using this tool that I'd used briefly before, which is called FileMaker. And Apple ties the two of those together. It provides you this really nice graphical user interface, has a built-in database, and it kind of is a wrapper as an app that you can load these little projects into. So here we go to converting it. I needed to figure out, okay, well, what could replace something like that? And one of the tools that I've used off and on since I got into Python and I've built some tools in it was Django. And Chris is way more experienced in Django. So I wanted to ask him some really specific things like, will this run well on an iPad? And I immediately thought, well, I don't like the way this thing handles the database because the database is going to be just on the iPad and I literally have to sort of take it off the device and move it somewhere else. And, you know, as far as backup, as far as file size and things like that, it'd be nice if there was like one answer of truth that we could use the magic of the internet to be able to access these things. So they would need an internet connection, which we agreed isn't going to be a problem. And we could probably still use the iPad, but I haven't done a lot of front-end type of stuff where you're using a touch interface on the web. And so I was asking Chris some of these questions, like, well, what do you think? Do you think HTMX might be a way?
One of the things you kind of have to go through when you're looking at these things, particularly when you're replacing a product, you kind of have to sort of have that the large set of buckets of what are the features, right?
Yeah.
And one of the advantages of an integrated app is you have full use of all the features of the iPad or a phone. And increasingly, you can get at those things through JavaScript if you're on a web page, but I've never done that. You've never done that. And so, you know, one of the early conversations we were having was, okay, well, before you get too far down any given path, go experiment with these things that are linchpins, right? So,
and I'm right there. I've just been doing all the thinking initially.
Yeah, right. And so if it turns out that the JavaScript interface for using the camera is problematic, well, then you've got to figure out, well, is the customer willing to take pictures with their phone and then upload it? If they're okay with that, then you can use a web interface.
Right.
But that feels like a step down from what they have. So, you know, that the early thing you're trying to do in these places is sort of try to reduce the risk. And you don't want to necessarily pick your stack based on, hey, this is what... I had a VP I worked with years ago, and one of the things he's like, oh, one of the things I love about working with this team is the tech stack is the last conversation they have.
Right.
And a lot of teams, it's the first conversation they have because we are a Django Python shop. So it's how can we, and sometimes that's a square peg and sometimes the hole is round. So understanding the client's requirements and what you're actually trying to achieve within the constraints is an important part of that, right?
Yeah, because I mean, most of the tests that they do are out in the field. They're either doing testing for materials that are toxic that could be in a building, be it asbestos, lead paint, what have you. And so I've built some apps that were designed around that, which is about taking the samples, documenting them, putting the measurements in, and then, you know, basically having a database of that, but being that it was an iPad, it had a camera on it ready to go. And so the person didn't have to like tie a bunch of other things in. They literally just like aimed it at the thing and could add the picture or remove it and put a different one in, which was really nice. And then similarly, like that kind of portability and the way that you can kind of make, I don't know, you see so many businesses out there walking around with iPads. I went to get my allergy shots and like the intake forms that people were using. They have these like ruggedized iPads so they can pass them around the office, which is a popular thing for that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the web, that like, yeah. That's the most natural thing. It was one of the earliest things they added to the web was the forms, right? Like how pretty the form is a whole other thing. But that's a fundamental concept to the web is, oh, I got to fill in this form, right? So, and for your applications, the question then is, okay, what goes in the form? And most of it is very form-like. And then you've got these couple small things that might be multimedia or interacting with another device or something. So,
right.
So again, you got to, you know, can I do that? And what are the different ways of doing that? And what does it look like, right?
Yeah. And you answered some of the questions I had before. I like Django partly because it does a lot of the administration stuff. It kind of comes out of the box with that. So me as an administrator, even though I live literally in another state from that person, I can go look at the database and also get, you know, sort of things installed, and they could be running it through the web, and I could look at the data that they're putting in and so forth. And then in the end, one of the things that I was able to do on that platform was to make reports. Again, they were doing this thing where they'd go out in the field with their clipboards and take that piece of paper, filthy thing, and run it through a scanner. And I always thought to myself, oh my God, how messy is all this stuff getting? And in the end, they would re-enter the data into like Excel. And so it was just like sort of like them just having like documentation that they were out in the field. So I wanted it to be more like, hey, you could put all this data in here and then like hit a button and it outputs like a PDF as a report. Mm-hmm. And they've loved it. And again, like they, you know, they've wanted like a handful of minor changes over the time. Most of these things are kind of coming up positive. But the other idea that is nice about Django that I've seen is this idea that it can be used for multiple applications. Like you can, you know, like one shop can have a landing space that then they switch. Okay, now we're going to do this type of testing or we're going to do that sort of stuff. Anyway, it's more of us kind of working through it.
Although this customer is your client, this is really, you're kind of operating like an internal IT shop.
Yeah.
And there is actually a difference in the dynamic of that relationship. And you'll find this often with things like using the Django admin, right? So you would not put the Django admin in a public place. Even if you'd secured it properly and all the rest of it, it's not the friendliest interface.
Right.
But it is trainable. And if you're dealing with a small set of people, and they have a particular need, you can get away with trainable a lot because you can show somebody how to use it. And the benefit of that is it doesn't necessarily have to be as self-evident and self-explory as, say, like a bank app, right? Because you're not going to sit down and no one's going to train you how to use the bank app.
I think a lot of CMS and publishing, depending on your level, you usually can leave a lot of it open for people to kind of look at in a certain sense.
Yeah, it's almost always done as a, I expect you to learn how to use this tool. And that is a different mindset. And that doesn't mean you don't do polish, doesn't mean you don't do security.
Right.
But you can get away with quicker and dirtier in some cases because of who your audience is, right?
That makes sense, yeah. Yeah, if it's not like a public-facing product.
Yes.
It's an internal team project, yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing, you know, a complete sort of tangent, but solo developer is kind of its own thing, right? We've spent a fair amount of time talking in the show about like teams and managers and two teams interacting and bigger projects and all the rest of it. And all the things that those organizations have to think about, you still have to think about it. You need requirements. You need some delivery. You need some testing. Solo developer, that there's, you become the product manager and the programmer and the QA person. And honestly, I think product management is probably the hardest part, because if you don't do it well, you will end up wasting a lot of your time.
Yeah,
you can go down avenues if you've made assumptions, that kind of stuff. The flip side of it is there's a nice advantage in the fact that it's a small thing. You don't have to coordinate amongst five developers and make sure they all understand, because you know, you can have a direct conversation with the people who are going to use it.
Yeah.
And that can make a big difference.
And I like that part. That's my favorite part, is watching somebody use the thing that you've built. And, you know, I used to do that as a trainer in a variety of other situations, you know, like, oh, you're grabbing for that. Okay, that's no. all right, I need to change that. You know, it's, you can kind of watch the interactions. It really shortens or sort of does a short circuit of like leaving a lot of those things out. Because I could be just building it for the person, you know, the boss or whatever, and showing it to him, and then he tosses it to the people. And it's like, there's always going to be miscommunication in there and frustration and people trying to please the person as opposed to like get possibly the work done. And
yeah,
or even asking like, what is possible? And that's always kind of fun to like, I didn't know we could do this. You know, it's like, okay, great. Yeah. And then everybody's kind of excited to continue to work on it.
And there's a particular joy that comes from particularly stuff that's like older. Like I've been in that situation where it's like 10 years on and I happen to talk to a former client and it's like, what do you mean you're still using that?
Yeah. he keeps telling me that all the time. And I'm like, holy cow.
Still up? It hasn't fallen over? Wow, that's nice. There's a certain programmer's joy that comes with that. That must have been bulletproof enough that they're still using it. It's a nice feeling.
Yeah, totally. So we might revisit this as I keep going. We'll see. Or maybe do it in a different format. Yeah, I'm excited to dive in, and I definitely have been clocking some hours on my own time, just sort of like thinking about stuff and sort of like setting up my stuff to start prototyping. And what's nice is the things already are built that I'm going to use as my platform. So a lot of the logic, quote unquote, business logic is there.
Right. It's just a transfer rather than a recreate. Yeah. I don't have to think about the reasoning behind it.
That's not going to be bad. You know, the hosting is another one that I got to think about. It's going to be a big one. So, yeah.
The original project basically becomes the baseline for the requirements.
Yeah. All right. Well, that gets us into projects, actual projects. And I guess I'll start. I want to make it known that I'm a little upset about this one. How can this project have been around for 4 years and no one told me about it? All right, there I said it. My project is by Steve Atkinson. It's called NAM, N-A-M, for Neural Amp Modeler. It's an open source project that uses deep learning to create models of guitar amplifiers and pedals with state-of-the-art accuracy. So the project is actually pretty elaborate and mature. There is a way that if you're a guitarist, the amp that they're talking about is like, you know, maybe you've heard of the brand Marshall or Fender or Mesa Boogie or whatever. Those big things that sit on top of a speaker cabinet. So this thing is going to model the way that thing sounds when you plug a guitar into it. And there's a way to use this project, even just as a guitarist, if you want to share it with a guitarist in your life. There are around 20 or more different companies that have actually made products using the modeling tools that this person's developed, which is pretty cool. But there's a free plugin for Windows or Mac that uses a technology called VST or audio unit. And that's one area where you got a little help, got a little project help with the C++ side of how to translate it. And there is a website called Tone 3000, and it's got tens of thousands of downloads already on it for thousands of models of gear, and guitarists have been sending all kinds of stuff in there with pictures of like what the equipment is and what they were doing. So if you're interested in making your own models of your own personal equipment, you can use an online tool. You can actually play what is an impulse audio file. It has like frequency sweeps and little sort of short impulses and other stuff that are happening inside of it. And that then gets played through a signal chain of basically your guitar amplifier and then recording its output. It's often called reamping a signal in the business here, like where you could take a guitar that you're like, oh, this sounds okay, but what would it sound like if it was running through this other amplifier? Or you could even do that with other types of things like, oh, I want drums to go through a piano to go through a guitar amp or something like that. And you sort of reamp the signal. So then when you have that audio recording, you play it kind of compared to the two of them, the software then does the modeling based upon the differences between those two. So again, there's a website if you want to do that. If you want to dig into the Python of it all and set it up on your own, there's also a Colab notebook, which could save you some steps, or you could set up the project on your own machine. The installation instructions, and I'll include the GitHub for this, suggested using Miniconda. It really uses PyTorch underneath the scenes here. If you have Windows, you're probably going to want like something like an NVIDIA GPU. On Apple, it can use Apple Silicon processors like the M series. And once it's set up, there's like a GUI interface. And basically, again, you have your input file, your output file, and then a destination for it. Creates a .nam file, a NAM file, and then a little area where you can add metadata, like what was the equipment used and so forth in there, and you know, describing what it is. Underneath the hood, it's using a variety of things, a WaveNet model, LSTM, long short-term memory, recurrent neural network, a bunch of really interesting stuff. The guy who created it, Steve, he has a nice blog post that sort of goes through the history of it, where it was like one of these, like, this is my Sunday crossword kind of project. I'm going to try to figure out how to do this thing and learn everything I need to do about it. Anyway, so I'm just a couple days in with playing with it. I'll probably play a little recording at the end of this to share what it sounds like. If you're interested, I'll put at the tail of the episode. The repo really excited me, 100% Python. And Steve's working on an update, so he'll have a version 2. If you are a guitarist, you say, well, how's it compared to like the Kemper amp modeling tool that's been around for about a decade? A lot of experts in the industry say it sounds better than that, and that's a multi-$1,000 amplifier. There's another one called the Quad Cortex that's like $1,000 or more pedal that you can get that can do similar types of things of modeling your equipment. Supposedly, again, it's advanced. This guy's been to the National Association of Music Merchants, the NAM show, which it might be confusing with the neural amp modeler name there. But he's been talking to different manufacturers and so forth, and they've been putting it in their products. So pretty cool. And it's Python. So if you're intrigued or want to learn a little more about it, what do you got?
My project this week is from another friend of the show, Al Swigert, author of the famous Automate the Boring Stuff with Python and several other books. Al's got a thing for ASCII art, and he frequently uses it to help teach new programmers core techniques. In celebration of the recent Artemis II accomplishment, I thought I'd mention one of Al's ASCII art tools, the ASCII Moon Phase Python Library. The title probably gives it all away. If you pip install the project, you get both a command line and interface and a library. On the command line, you call ASCII moon phase, and the result is an ASCII art rendering of the moon with its current phase. There are arguments to specify a date, change the rotation and size, to change the characters used to print the light and dark parts, and a way to do animation if you like. All of this, of course, is available through the library as well, returning a string to your code, which you can then print yourself or do whatever it is you're going to do with an ASCII art moon. Projects like this are fun, but they're also a great place to dive into reading code. If you're new to programming, something smallish and self-contained like this is a good place to practice. And it turns out that May is going to have a blue moon. So Al has a version in Rust. If you'd prefer to see it a little faster, you can get that 2 full moons in a month for your lunar entertainment.
Nice. All right, Chris. Well, thanks for bringing all these projects, news, and topics this week.
Cheers. I'll see you soon.
Thanks again to Build Your Own Coding Agent for sponsoring this episode. If the AI hype has been wearing thin, and you'd rather see the actual requests.post call behind it all, this is the book for you. RealPython listeners get 10% off with code RealPython at buildyourowncodingagent.com. Or you can click the banner for a link in the show notes. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon. All right, if you stuck around to the end, here is some sound examples of the neural amp modeler I was talking about earlier. This is plugged into a Motu M2. This is my Yamaha electric guitar, clean, just straight into the interface. And this is loaded up in the NAMM plugin with a Roland Jazz Chorus 120. And now for a higher gain distortion, I'm using an ENGL model, Engel. First again is the clean, just direct sound. So I want to thank Steve Atkinson for making Neural Amp Modeler.